Hello, I am Rob Bavarnik, and this is Money Matters, a show where your money matters. Today, we have the distinct honor and privilege of being joined by Albert Dandridge of the firm of Schneider, Harrison, Siegel, and Lewis, an absolutely fascinating person. And we'll go through a number of topics with him in a few minutes, but as we always do at the beginning of the show, we address a viewer question. And this question comes from Walter Nance of Philadelphia. And Walter asks, how do you qualify for pro bono legal services? Walter, it is a great question under any circumstances, but it is a particularly good question with our guest, Al, as I'll get to in a minute. So there are a number of ways to access pro bono legal services. There are a number of programs throughout the Philadelphia area that you can contact and get a pro bono lawyer. Among them is something called Philadelphia VIP, which is was a volunteer for the indigent persons, which we have a lot of lawyers in Philadelphia. They volunteer their time. They're on a list. And people will contact, it's phillyvip.org. They contact Philly VIP depending on the nature of the law, and they will match you up with a lawyer who will fit that particular type of law. In my firm, I know that we've done a number of divorce cases. Interestingly, it's not an area of practice that the firm really focuses on, but one of the attorneys in the office had an interest in doing that, saw a need, and said, I'm going to do that, and so he's done that for a number of clients. And there are other types of law you can do for that. If you're interested in Chapter 7 bankruptcy, there is something called the Consumer Bankruptcy Assistance Project, known as CBAP. And they take on indigents in Chapter 7s, and it's obviously experienced bankruptcy lawyers who do that. And you can look up Consumer Bankruptcy Assistance Project on the web, and I'm just looking at my notes, and that's also at cbap-philly.org is the website for that. And also within the philly.org site is something called LawWorks, and that is a website that will help you match you up with a lawyer in the small business world. So that's one way. Another way is you contact the local bar association and ask for assistance. And what's great about that is that many, if not all, of the large firms have that as part of their normal program. Now, in Florida, where I also practice, it's part of the requirements each year that each lawyer has a requirement, a guideline to do at least 25 hours of pro bono work. We don't have that requirement in Pennsylvania, but it's something that most law firms and most lawyers do. And in fact, I'm going to throw it over to Al right now, because I know, Al, at your firm, Schneider, they do the same thing. Perhaps you can discuss for a minute what the firm does in terms of pro bono work.
We do, and it's a good question, and I think you explained a great deal of it. But those who are interested in getting a lawyer to help them on a pro bono basis, my suggestion would be, one of the first contacts would be the Philadelphia Bar Association, which can kind of guide you to some of the programs that you talked about, LawWorks and VIP and others. VIP generally deals with business type matters, and so if you have a business type matter and you need pro bono representation, then maybe they can guide you to VIP. There are other entities, from community legal services to all kinds of entities that, depending on what the issue is, can help you or at least guide you in the direction of helping out. So the Bar Association is and Philadelphia lawyers in general are nationally known for their pro bono work, what they do to try to help the public. And the Bar Association can lead you to some of these organizations. But the problem is that the need so outweighs the amount of resources that are available through your general, typical organizations that can help in a particular area. So law firms such as mine will also step up. And so law firms have, most of the major firms, as you described, allow lawyers to take on pro bono matters. And there are certain law firms that will specialize in various areas, or there are certain matters that they have a great deal of expertise in that they'll undertake. But our firm, as you described, gives credit to our lawyers, you know, to take on a pro bono matter. So it's as if you're taking on a full playing client, and you know, it would be an engagement and the whole nine yards. And so one of the things that we got a lot of publicity this last year is a couple of our lawyers belong to the Innocence Project. And so we got a lot of publicity getting one inmate out who was falsely accused of murder and was incarcerated for a great deal of time. And we spent people on our firm spent countless hours getting that individual, you know, who was innocent, a new trial, and went through the process of getting him out. So lawyers in Philadelphia, lawyers all over the country, but lawyers in Philadelphia particularly are known for their pro bono efforts. And if you, you know, cannot afford a lawyer and you have a cause that, you know, someone wants to undertake, there are a plethora of ways that you can try to go about to do that.
I appreciate that. And we're talking about Philadelphia, but for those of you watching the outlying counties, the same type of thing. One of your first calls should be to the local Bar Association, Montgomery, Delaware, Chester, whatever county you may be in. So, Walter, I hope that helped to answer your question. And if you have any questions that you want us at Money Matters to answer, here's how you go about it.
You can have your questions answered on Money Matters. Please go to our website, money-matterstv.com. On our homepage, click on the banner on the right that says, Send Us Your Questions. While you're on our website, you can find information about our host and guests, as well as show notes and links about this show and past shows. Money Matters is also available as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, so you can listen to Money Matters while you're on the go. That website address, again, is money, M-O-N-E-Y, dash matters, M-A-T-T-E-R-S-T-V.com.
And we are back. Again, it's my pleasure today to have Al Dandridge from the Schneider Harrison firm. What's interesting is quite often when people come in here, we have lawyers of different ilks talking about pretty micro matters, what kind of a company do I form, and things like that. And we're totally, totally honored today to have Al Dandridge, because not only is Al a giant, and I mean that absolutely, truly, in the Philadelphia legal community, but Al's an interesting person. Al, as we were talking about before we went on air, before he became a lawyer, was a Marine, Bronze Star, Purple Heart. Before I say anything else, thank you for your service.
Thank
it is
you.
Greatly appreciated.
Thank you.
And he's been at Schneider for many, many years, has risen through the ranks. And one of the other things that he's done outside of the firm is that he was the chancellor in 2015 of the Philadelphia Bar, head of the whole Bar Association. How many members
12,
are there? 12,000. 12,000. And by the end of your year, you probably knew the names of each one.
No, but I had the email addresses.
Then I'm sure you got a lot of emails. And we were talking before about how do you do a job like that and still carry on a full practice? And you had a wonderful expression. You called it what?
The expandable day.
And that's exactly what it is. And obviously, there are only 24 hours in most people's days, so things have to give. And generally what gives, and I think it was the case in for Al, sleep was the one thing that...
That was the variable, yes.
So are you a lifer at the Schneider firm, or did you come from another firm?
I came from a firm that joined the Schneider firm, so technically, yes and no. But you could, I guess, call me a Schneider lifer, you know, because the firm, I was with the Meswell firm, which merged with the Schneider firm. About 18 years ago.
I remember that firm well. It was a very good firm, which, by the way, is most famous for a very specific reason. Why is the Meserov firm, what's it really known for? It was the scene of a movie, right? Didn't they film
it? It was the scene of the Philadelphia.
The Philadelphia was filmed there.
Was filmed there, and interestingly, if I could tell a brief story.
Absolutely.
So I'm sitting in my office, and we kind of knew what was going on, but before we really... was fully engaged in the project, the director came through our offices, and I hear this guy coming down the hallway, and it was Jonathan Demme, the director, and he's saying, this is great, I'm loving this, this is great. And he's looking at the offices, he's looking at our library and everything, and I sort of stick my head out, and what is this guy talking about? And it was Jonathan Demme, and he was getting ready to come in and do the shoots, and so we had Denzel Washington and Tom Hanks come through, and it was great. You know, you could stand right behind the camera, you can go in, and you know, they were very, you know, very allowing. You can walk around and see what, as long as you didn't get in the way of the camera, you can see what was going on. You could talk to Denzel, you could talk to Tom Hanks, and we had a preview of the movie. So we rented a theater when the movie first came out, and had our clients and our friends and family go and look at the premiere of the movie. So it was a great experience. It was a lot of fun.
I've always found that to be fascinating, the process of making a movie. And one of the things about it is it doesn't go in the order of the movie. And I always marvel at the actor's ability to change their emotions throughout whatever scene they're filming. So it had to be wonderful watching that.
It was just wonderful. I mean, again, you know, the two superstars in the film world to be, you know, up close and personal and just walk around and have them talk and shoot the breeze. And so it was a great experience.
And you found them to be approachable.
Very, very much approachable.
That's really good to hear, because that's another thing that we always wonder. These people that we see on the big screen, are they divas or are they good people?
No,
and these two people have reputations as being approachable, and it's nice to know
they were not divas. They were approachable.
That is really good. So let's talk a little bit about some law things. And even though I'd probably be happy to spend the whole time talking about movies, not really related to money matters. So one of the things I'm interested in is social media and the internet. Now, you've been practicing for a few years, so how have you seen that change? What do we as lawyers need to be aware of? And more importantly, what does our viewing audience need to be aware of when we're talking about things that they may see on social media and the internet?
Well, technology-wise, it's just had an enormous effect on the practice of law. When I was a young associate in a law firm, again, I think a lot of people my age kind of tell the story of typewriters and carbon paper and you know, many, many drafts of documents and things like that. And so technology has just taken us light years in the practice of law. But a couple of areas that, you know, I think I'd like to talk about just briefly is that the speed of the practice has just increased so much. And so clients, you know, would call you on the phone, or, you know, years ago, or write you a letter, and so on and so forth. And so there was an interval where, you know, you would talk to somebody on the phone and get back to them, or you get a letter and you think about it and write a letter back. Well, now clients email you. And I use the term speed kills, because people will email you and your first reaction is to email them right back. And sometimes, you know, there is not a lot of thought that goes into what that response ought to be and how that response should be given to the client or another attorney or anybody else. And so I think from that aspect, you know, you have to slow down a little bit. You have to, you know, kind of compose your thoughts, you know, because emails are last forever. And, you know, and one of the quirks that I have, or one of the things that I don't like to see is, you know, it's bad English. You know, you send an email and it's not discernible, and so you still have to, you know, give an intelligent answer, and it can't be just a tweet. So it's really different from that. So it's the speed of it, and clients want answers right away, since they can contact you right away. They want answers right away, and so you have to adjust to that. The other thing is that the rules of professional conduct try to keep up with our technology. And so one of the things is, are you protecting, you know, your client's information? So that's a big issue right now. Lawyers are have an obligation under the rules of professional conduct to keep their client information confidential. And so, you know, you try not to have somebody hack into your email. You try to send the email to the right person. You try to figure out, you know, don't reply to all, you know, in particular situations. And so trying to keep the information protected is an ongoing issue. Another issue is that lawyers are required, the rules of professional conduct say, that you have to be technologically proficient. And so, you know, old timers such as myself, and some older than I am, you know, or maybe grew up in a different era, you know, you have to be technologically advanced. You got to have an email. I mean, there may be some older lawyers that not facile with email and don't want to do it. Well, this is the 21st century. You got to do it. And the rules of professional conduct are saying that you have to be technologically updated. So you have to be able to respond to email. You have to know how to protect clients' information. And so I think the profession is trying to catch up with technology, but as you know, as we all see, technology is moving at warp speed, and I think the profession has to try to keep up as best it can.
Now, what about advertising, and specifically, I see a lot of times there may be testimonials that are on a website or not, and how should a client or a potential client view a testimonial on somebody's website?
Well, as you may know, and certainly I know you know, Rob, and maybe where part of this question is coming from, years ago lawyers weren't allowed to advertise. That was thought to be a breach of you know, not only professional conduct, but of etiquette. And so lawyers basically, you know, in the very old days, you had a business card, and that was basically it. You give a client or give a potential client your business card, and it was basically by reputation. That's how lawyers were generally hired. And so years ago, the courts kind of slacked up a little bit and alleviated the ability to advertise. So lawyers can now advertise, you know, where you know years ago they couldn't. But still, the rules of professional conduct say, although you can advertise, you still have to be truthful. So you cannot mislead anybody. You cannot tell an untruth. So although you're now allowed to advertise, you cannot say something that is false. You cannot say something that is misleading. You cannot tell an untruth in your advertising.
Now, and I know that there are different rules depending on the state you're in, because I know that Pennsylvania views that differently than New Jersey does, for example.
Or Florida, as you
Florida,
said.
It's correct. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So that's the one thing that you need to be aware of. I mean, my view is that if you're a potential client and you're on somebody's website and you see these testimonials, first of all, you know that they're always going to be good testimonials, just like a letter of recommendation. Nobody's going to ever send out a bad letter of recommendation.
Hopefully not.
But that's true. If that's going to happen, you've got other issues.
That's correct.
But the same thing with testimonials. So just look at it with a grain of salt if you're a potential client. There are certain things that we can't, as you say, certain things that you can and cannot say. Now, that doesn't mean that all lawyers follow those rules precisely, but as a client, you need to be very proactive and you need to do your research. I would never make a buy decision based on just a testimonial, but talk to your friends and family, to talk to other people, and get other recommendations, and don't do it simply on what you're seeing on, whether it's a testimonial, whether it's an ad that you've heard on the radio.
I think that's good general advice, yes.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
So before you were with the Meseroff firm, you were with the Securities and Exchange Commission.
That's correct.
And a large part of your practice is still securities.
Yes, correct.
So how have you seen that area of law change over the years, and what do you see coming over the horizon, particularly with this new administration?
Well, I spent two tours with the SEC. So out of law school, I went to the Securities and Exchange Commission. I was a special counsel with the Division of Corporation Finance. And then it came to the Meseroff firm, and they tried to get me to go back to the SEC, and I always sort of refused, and finally they kind of made me an offer I couldn't refuse, and I went back in the senior position. And so I spent two wonderful tours with the SEC. It's a great organization, and to describe it, at least in historically and in the arena that we now find ourselves in, the SEC by and large, if you take the whole SEC and its multifold divisions, has two charges, and those two charges sort of are in tension with each other. They sort of compete against each other. So one of their charges is capital formation. In other words, to have the ability to allow companies and allow firms to aggregate capital in an efficient manner and then have that capital go to its best and most efficient use. So capital formation, trying to get businesses to generate business and try to allocate capital, is one of the things that the SEC is charged with. The other thing that they're charged with is investor protection. And so those things tend to be in tension with each other. And so the SEC is always trying to figure out, okay, you know, what are our rules and regulations? How are we going to protect the investing public at the same time foster capital formation? And so one of the things that I always loved about the SEC is they try not to lead in that. I mean, a lot of organizations can kind of lead. They tried to follow. They wanted to see what the market was going to do. They wanted to see what the problems were and then kind of react to them. So they weren't going to try to dictate how you were going to act. They were going to, you know, with their two charges, they were going to see where the tensions were and how to operate. Now, one of the issues may be is, you know, where is that tension going to be under the new administration? Is it going to be more in the arena of trying to foster investor protection, or is it going to be more in the arena of trying to foster capital formation? Well, I think we all know which direction we think it may be going in, and whether or not that's a problem, I don't know. But I think the SEC, you know, which is with its professional staff, are going to try to be very professional about it and figure out, you know, how to navigate, you know, new waters. And they've done that since 1933. So I'm assuming that they're going to be able to do it again.
Do you stay in contact with people down at the SEC?
I do stay in contact with people down at the SEC. That's correct.
Which always is helpful in case you
need
to.
Well, it's a brotherhood and a sisterhood. Sure. And, you know, and you know people and you deal with people for many, many years. And so you tend to have an affinity for the organization and you tend to have an affinity for the people and what they're trying to do because you understand it.
Yeah. Now, I know another issue that's near and dear to your heart is the issue of diversity.
Yes.
So talk to me a little bit about what you've done in terms of diversity, both on a macro level and also within the firm.
Well, I'm as well as being a partner at the firm, I'm also the chief diversity officer of the firm. So I'm the one that, you know, tries to lead the effort on a firm-wide basis to increase diversity. And what I mean by that is to have as many voices in our organizations, as many representatives of our various communities here in America in our organization as possible. So I try to do that at the firm, and I've also tried to do that on a more macro level when I was Chancellor of the Philadelphia Bar Association. Certain organizations that I belong to, one is called the Philadelphia Diversity Law Group, which is a consortium of about 35 major law firms and corporate law departments here in Philadelphia, trying to increase diversity in our ranks, in our law ranks here in Philadelphia. Philadelphia is not a leader, unfortunately, in the arena. I mean, but we're trying. I mean, certain firms, and I think I count my firm among them, are starting to do a very good job. But Philadelphia still has a little bit of a ways to go when you match us against other cities like Atlanta or San Francisco or Los Angeles, things like that. But it's a slow process, and we're working our way along. But I'd like to use the term when we talk about diversity on a macro level. People kind of ask what it is, and it's trying to get as many trying to get a firm or trying to get an organization to represent what the community looks like, and to try to get as many people in. And I think you get a better product by having as many voices as possible trying to solve clients' problems. And one of the terms that I always looked at and thought was endearing is one of the big diversity consultants in the United States, a woman by the name of Renee Myers, coined a phrase which I think encapsulates it. You know, so the term now is diversity and inclusion. And she said, and trying to define it, you know, what is diversity? Well, she says diversity is being invited to the party. Inclusion is being asked to dance. And I think that captures the whole tenor of what we try to do. Try to get as many people to the party as possible, but not only have them at the party, but have them be meaningful participants in what you're trying to do. So, you know, the invite to the party and the ask to dance, I think, is a quick way to encapsulate what most diversity programs are going to try to do. And one of the things that I do and others is to try to make people aware of what the issues are and what a diverse community looks forward to and how we can interact. And I think we're starting to try to do a better job of that.
Now, I'm a little bit surprised that you say that Philadelphia is a lagging indicator in the world of diversity.
Correct.
Because from my perspective, you can only benefit by having diversity because people come from different backgrounds. They
Absolutely.
Have different perspectives, diversity of thought, and we all become better when we are open to listening to how other people think, not only in the law, but also certainly just in regular life. But I could
it's a better product.
It is a far better product. Yes. And as a lawyer, we can better assist our clients if we are able to expand our own minds and look at problems from different ways.
Well, I think lawyers are a little bit slow to change. We are a little stuffy sometimes, but I think we're starting to change. But one of the main ways to change is from the top. Top management has to be fully involved, and in our firm, top management is fully involved. And I think when it comes from the top, and the direction is set from the top, then I think everybody else follows along. In corporations, that's easy to do. If the CEO says, this is what we're going to do, or the board says, this is what we're going to do, then everybody else generally is going to follow that. A law firm is a little bit of a different animal. But still, if it comes from the top and the top has buy-in, then everybody else generally tends to have buy-in as well. I think we're starting to do a very good job at that.
What's interesting, as you well know, one of our requirements as lawyers is we have certain continuing education obligations. We have 12 hours a year, some of which have to be ethics. But I will tell you that I don't remember seeing a lot of courses on diversity. Perhaps that's something that we can contact the local bar association and say, let's have some courses, unless I happen to have missed them. Are they out there?
They are out there. I mean, most, Philadelphia Diversity Law Group, we have programs, almost on a yearly basis. And we did a big diversity symposium in 2015. And it was an all-day symposium with CLE credits. And so a lot of the members of the local bar participated in that symposium and got significant CLE credits for doing that. So more and more what you're going to see and what we've seen in the last couple of years is just as you said, from a diversity standpoint, there are programs that are structured to allow for continuing legal education credits to participate in things like that.
Now, I have to imagine that you probably do a lot of teaching in terms of legal education, so you don't have to attend many classes. Do you attend many still?
I attend some, but as you know, you can build up credits. And so I usually lose more, because you can only carry over so many from year to year. So I usually lose more than I'm able to carry over. So by teaching or doing courses or other endeavors, I'm usually way ahead of the curve as to my required 12 hours every year. I'd lose 30, 40 hours every year because I have so many.
So when you go to a CLE, do you do something within your core competency, or do you say, I know that I'm going to do something that I have no experience in?
Well, I'll answer that, and also tell you a dirty little secret. So the answer is most people try to attend a CLE course where that's going to be in their core area of competency to get more in-depth of knowledge as to a particular practice area. Some people, as you suggested, will take a CLE course, something that may be completely outside of their practice area, something that they're interested in or something they want to learn for the first time. And people do that. Another aspect of it is that you are in groups. And so your group has a time frame in which to be eligible for your CLE credits. And so when you get close to the end of that time frame, some people will go and sit in on anything just to get the credits.
I know that is very true. I've been on both sides. I've been a participant and I've been a student in those. So I would love to talk to you for the next 3 or 4 hours. However, we are out of time. I do want to thank you all. I want to thank Al for taking time out of his busy day to come and join us today. I want to thank you for watching as always. Next time, the guest will be David Fries from the Unruh Turner Burke and Fries firm. So as always, thank you for watching. We appreciate it. And just keep in mind that your money matters. Thank you.